good. All right. Good afternoon. Consider this the call to order of the Privacy, Confidentiality, and Security Subcommittee meeting for June 11th, 2014. And we're working as a breakout, but at the same time, the committee of the whole. As published, our agenda is tight, substantive this afternoon. We're already 8 minutes late, so we'll move very quickly. Our main item of business this afternoon is to go through the design goals, substance of the draft of the Community Data User Toolkit, and that's really most of our meeting. Then we're going to spend some time talking about where we go from here with this project of developing dynamic tools for community data users. Then we will have about a 20-minute discussion to follow up on the great introduction that Joy did this morning on data segmentation for privacy. Walter's going to share some work that he's done to summarize the status of standards and technology in this emerging area, and then we'll talk about next steps. Just as a reminder, our work plan for this year as a subcommittee is, as you see, items 1A and 1B really are following up on prior work that the subcommittee has done on stewardship best practices. And our goal has been to really do the research, do some kind of workshop or other activity to advance best practices in the area of stewardship for community use, and produce a report that our plan would be to have come to the committee for approval at the September meeting. So our goal today is to review a draft so that we have the summer to get it into whatever is final shape, but we don't ever think we probably will be final with this, but we'll talk more about that later. Our other work plan was to develop the privacy and security section of the HIPAA report. Happily, we're stamped that completed. And our third major goal for the year was to advise on other privacy issues, merging issues, outstanding HIPAA-related issues, topic to be determined. And that is really what we're taking up in data segmentation, not necessarily that that's the topic, but it certainly is an emerging area, and I hope after, we hope that coming out of that discussion we'll decide whether there's meaningful work that the subcommittee should do in this area or if there's another area. So this is kind of the open-ended, more deliberative part of the meeting today. But as I said, the substance of today is to solicit your feedback on the draft toolkit. And so with that, I ask Leslie to introduce our learned contractor who's been terrific, Maureen Henry, who is at the computer and has been working with us for the past number of months.
So just very briefly about Maureen, she's a JD, and she is a former director of the Governor's Commission on Aging in Utah, and last year she was a Politics and Aging Fellow in the office of Senator John Warner from Virginia. And we're very fortunate that she's finishing a PhD in nursing at Utah and was available to do some part-time work for us as a consultant. And she's, we'll just turn it over to Maureen to run us through. The idea of this, let me just say, is we want to get, we don't want to do any wordsmithing. We want to get some any ideas members of the committee have for things that either don't feel right, additions, things you think we ought to take out, and so on. because there will be another draft. The goal is approval in September.
I just have a question. Our subcommittee call just last week went through this process.
Right.
So for this comments already shared, this is the same draft we're seeing that we've already worked through. Is that right?
Some of the changes from last week's meeting were integrated, not all of them, given the tight time frame between the meeting and when the materials for this came out. So if you've given anything that is either a TBD or other comments from last week's meeting, then that will be coming.
I just also want to thank Hedy Kahn and Amy Chapper for helping us note take during this discussion.
And the other thing I'll say about the proximity of last week's subcommittee meeting and the materials for this meeting is that there were some last-minute changes, and one that I saw today is that somehow in trying to fix the pages, I eliminate them. So if you do have comments, then you can go by section name. That should get us close enough to where you're going, but my apologies if you're looking at a hard copy because the page numbers came off in those last-minute changes.
So I'm going to most are probably looking at the PDF.
If you're looking at the PDF, then you can just go by the numbers in the PDF pages that you're looking at this point. But if you're looking, as I see Jack is with a hard copy, then pages. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So
the table of contents in the e-agenda book for this report are on page 103.
Okay.
Begins on 103.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So I'll start by going back to the beginning of where what we're trying to do and the objectives. So the objective of this project was to provide guidance for the use of data to improve community health. There, we began with an emphasis on privacy, confidentiality, and security, but the toolkit is not limited to privacy, confidentiality, and security, because you can't do a data stewardship toolkit without getting into some of the other areas like data integrity. So it's not limited to that, but that is a primary focus of the document. What came before the toolkit, there were three documents that have come out of past activities of the subcommittee. One of them, most recent one, was the Joint Roundtable on Health Data Needs for Community-Driven Change. The one prior to that was the Stewardship Framework Letter that was sent to Secretary Sebelius in 2012. And prior to that was the Community as a Learning System, Using Local Data to Improve Local Health. So in order to come up with what went into to guide the drafting of the toolkit, one of the things that we did was we went back to these three documents and in particular looked at the recommendations from each of those reports as guidance on where we should go with this toolkit. In addition to that, we did an environmental scan, including the review of the past reports. On top of the review of the reports, I also spoke with about 20 people overall. That information was provided in the last full committee hearings materials, where I talked to people about emerging issues in this area and what they saw as the most helpful pieces of what would go into a toolkit. There was both a culling process because initially it seemed too broad to deal with in a document like this. At the same time, there were some expansions, like I said, into things like data lifecycle, which isn't necessarily directly related to the privacy, confidentiality, and security piece. And at the last full committee meeting, the charge that I walked away with and the subcommittee walked away with was to develop a community data user toolkit. We've spent a fair amount of time during some of the subcommittee meetings talking about the target audience. So communities generally are the target audience. Some examples of communities that we discussed were local government agencies, nonprofit organizations, disease-specific groups. At the same time, we've heard from subcommittee members that both further up in the government chain, so potentially county level, potentially state level organizations might have an interest in this, but we wrote it at, we directed it primarily at a less sophisticated user group. So we're not directing this at directors of state public health departments. We're directing it more at an educated but not necessarily very knowledgeable in the use of data to improve community health audience, if that makes any sense. So what we tried to do is take a lot of this information from past hearings and filter it down to a point where it could provide a nice outline, but not necessarily all the detail that organizations would need to use community data. The structure of the toolkit has changed a little bit over several drafts, but we are trying to frame it as we framed the data stewardship concept as outlined in the letter to the Secretary in 2012. So these are the subparts of that: community and individual engagement and accountability, which the first two are both separate sections within the toolkit, but then in addition to that, they are addressed at every other section because to some degree, both the engagement with individuals and communities and accountability needs to be accounted for throughout the other parts of the framework. We have sections on, in addition to those two, on purpose specification, data quality and integrity, data security, openness, transparency, and choice, and to protect de-identified data from re-identification. So the structure within the document follows the framework in this section. We've also addressed the data life cycle, again, for the purpose of highlighting to community data users that there is a life cycle to data that includes a number of different steps: collecting, processing, analyzing, reporting, storing, destruction, repurposing, and then repurposed data would then cycle back into the system. So we've addressed how that works. And the other thing that's addressed in the text of the report is assuring quality throughout the data life cycle. Under each one of the sections, we've provided a brief explanation for the topic. We, in addition to that, and this is not yet in there because this was something that was morphing right up until we turned the draft in for today's meeting, and that is how to use the case studies. And what was decided at the last meeting was that we would have narratives in one section at the back of the report, but then we'd have blurbs from those narratives that illustrated the points that were made in each one of the sections throughout the toolkit. So, as I said, those are coming. That structure didn't get decided until just before the materials for today came in. And then for each section, we also are providing checklists that give the data users things to think about. And those are found at the end of each one of the sections. We have identified some case studies, the ones that are listed on this slide and the ones that are at the document that you have for today are the ones that we think illustrate a range of different issues across the data stewardship, the framework. If any of you have examples of other case studies that you think would be helpful, please let us know, because this doesn't have to be the final group of case studies that we're looking at. We were just talking over lunch today about how there may be closer to the community level examples out there that we haven't found based on who's testified in past meetings, and so we don't want to miss those if there are other examples that are out there that would be effective in demonstrating how this could work well or potentially not as well at the community level. In the emails and calls that I made as part of the environmental scan, we asked both for successes and non-successes, and we didn't really get many of the examples of the non-successes. And it may be that there are illustrations out there that should be identified that would give examples of how things have gone wrong in the past. Some of these are examples of that. For example, the Havasupai tribe biological samples is a good example on a larger scale of something going wrong.
I think we should probably take questions or comments as we go.
So exciting to see this developing. It's great. I think I just building on the Datapalooza a week ago, there was an interesting app. I'm trying to think what it was called. But basically, they just took federal data and made it available in, I think, Chicago, where you could go and find resources for domestic violence, whereas if you just Google that, it's all over the place. So I was struck by the fact that very simple things can be transformative in the community. It was just cataloging, thinking who's the user and what is it. So that could be – I'll have the name here somewhere. But the other – what is it? Yeah, it was Purple Folder, exactly. And the other thing is the title, Community Data – is it Community Data User or Community Data User?
And I think that the way we've thought about this is both, that it could be communities doing data collection locally. Some of these examples are like the Taking Neighborhood Health to Heart, which you may have heard from the Denver project that was talked about in past meetings, where they actually did original data collection within the community and with a lot of success at engaging the community in that process. In other cases, it may be that like, the eMERGE network and what you're describing would be communities taking data from outside sources, sometimes local sources, local health departments, sometimes national sources like the CDC, and using them targeted within the community. So we're looking at both.
And so you're right. So are there sort of types? What is it that you want to show by the case studies? Because there are a lot of different things. So is it, if you had to say the overarching theme is I'm looking for case studies that will demonstrate
both communities using data to promote health at the local level and that example with data sources coming from different places. Does that make sense?
But with a bias to personally identifiable or more sensitive data with stewardship dimensions.
So that's important.
So the case studies, some of them, like the Taking Neighborhood Health to Heart, the whole story is told. If you remember in the 2011 report, there were little digests at the end. But what we're going to have are boxes that, so we're talking about a particular aspect of stewardship, say, data integrity. There'd be a little box that would describe what a community did with respect to data integrity. So a community that wants to either collect or use data can know what to think about and see how somebody else thought about this with respect to data integrity.
Okay, so it goes back to those, it's privacy and confidence.
It's all of the elements of the stewardship framework that we're looking at. So data integrity is one. Community engagement. So different examples highlight different aspects of each piece of the stewardship
framework. On the page 107 diagram.
Okay, so you'll be looking for, if you're looking for case studies, it's things
to illustrate those points,
Those elements.
those elements.
Right. But every case study doesn't have to exhibit all seven.
No. I think as we were viewing it, the Taking Neighborhood Health to Heart is nice because it does illustrate every step in the process. It's a tremendous example of a community-based participatory research project where the community was engaged from conceptualization through analysis to disseminating results and then cycling back into the process. So that one does illustrate every step in the process. The others, I don't know that any of the others does to the same degree that that one does. And so that will be the most extensive case study, and it will show up in many of the blocks. Some of the other ones will highlight examples that are pulled out of it but wouldn't necessarily show every step.
You were asking for ideas of case studies, and I think we had, I think, one day of privacy hearings with the Community as a Learning Health System report, and there was someone who testified from New York. It might have been the HIE. And I think we later heard that there were issues with that consent process. So going back to that might be helpful. At the time we heard the testimony, the issues hadn't arisen, but I think we heard later, maybe through public reports, that they had to reverse course.
The Bronx project.
Thank you.
Vicki?
Great.
Part of what I'm trying to understand in terms of the cases, because there's a bunch of cases, like telling us, like, what would be helpful, like where do you have a gap or something? Because we could dig up some cases, but I want to make sure it's what you need, because there are very few cases other than, you know, that's going to cover all of them. So is it that you need something on the positive for which of the attributes?
It's a good comment. And I think maybe we should move on to the sections of the report, because the way we're designing it now, these would, you know, the entire case study would come as appendices. And we were doing that because at the joint roundtable, one of the recommendations made is, you know, let us see how others have done this. Let's hear Chris's comment, and we'll move on.
Yes, would really like to spend some time talking with you about community comments, and it's a public good utility where we have a lot of data, a lot of national source data, but abilities for integrating and uploading local and regional data. But as we work with nonprofits, local government, et cetera, it's really, as I heard a couple of people say, it's through the narrative. It's the stories that we're telling, where we've embedded the maps or the data as part of the story. So when you see what's going on around in Chattanooga around food and food security or systems, you can then click on another community in the country with the same data coming up. So how do you contextualize data, local and regional, and mixing it, like you said, maybe with federal data to tell the story? And with cases, it's limited in some ways to just that area, but then how do we expand that to other communities around the country so it's meaningful in different areas?
Thank you. Okay. The final section of the, well, next to the last section of the report addresses regulatory and legal structures, including HIPAA and human subjects protections. It is not meant to be a comprehensive review of law that might apply to data use, and it's not meant to imply that all health data is covered by HIPAA, or that the human subjects protections through IRB and other similar academic models are the only way to go. We did want to put it in there, one, because some of the data that people may want to access may be protected under HIPAA or may be the result of generation from a de-identified data set and therefore have some HIPAA implications. at the last meeting, we talked about how, and this is one of the pieces that didn't get into the draft, that, for example, HIPAA, it's important for people at the community level to understand what HIPAA does and doesn't require so that a community data user would be able to ask for the right things from people who have HIPAA-protected data. So we wanted to give people just at least a brief understanding of how they might be able to address the issue of HIPAA in trying to access data, for example, from healthcare providers or from an HIE. The other reason to put the HIPAA and the Human Subjects Protections sections in the toolkit is that they are both the result of a lot of thought about how to protect privacy and about how to address these kinds of concerns. And so even if they don't govern the specific use of the data, they're illustrative of how one would go about protecting this kind of data when it's being used, especially more sensitive data. And even when you're dealing with something like it that may be HIPAA or that may not be HIPAA protected because it's de-identified, that human subjects protections may go further in a university IRB setting because it might be more cognizant of risks of re-identification that are a little bit off the radar on the HIPAA side. So we put some detailed information about these two systems into the report for those purposes, and we'll be pulling the threads back and tying that together more thoroughly in the next draft. We also covered the issue of data use agreements, and we've covered those, again, both in terms of how they might be required under HIPAA, but also because if a community is getting information, we wanted the community to have an understanding of what a data use agreement might do and how a data use agreement can help with the re-identification issue in terms of spelling out the requirements of a data user. So we've gone into some detail about data use agreements, and in the appendix, at the templates at the end, we'll include both a sample notice of privacy practices as well as data use agreements. Again, the notice of privacy practices is not intended to be limited to HIPAA, but to be used as an example of how community data users could let people know that their data may be used in one way or another. So it's HIPAA serving as a template for other uses, not just a notice of privacy practices within the HIPAA context. So that is the overview of the toolkit as we framed it up to this point. Do you want to, I'll give it back to you, Linda.
Should we bring it up?
Sure. The current draft version is in your packets, and it's fairly good size, so there aren't printed copies of it. We are going to have a virtual reactor workshop, a couple hours in July. To that, we're inviting everybody who's been involved in all the discussions Maureen has had, everybody who has testified at the prior MCVHS sessions that went into the generation of the toolkit. If you've had a chance to, so we're gonna use that time to get feedback from the likely audience. So if you have thoughts of people that would be good givers of feedback on this, so we can invite them to participate on the 16th, that would be super helpful at this point. And if you've had a chance to look at it, one of the goals of the way it's designed that Maureen has really worked hard on is to have it be very user-friendly so that, for example, checklists or there are a lot of graphics in it, a lot of nice, nice charts and things like that.
I'm going to bring it up and just scroll through it if you have comments on.
Vicki and Larry.
I agree with you. I think that it's very user-friendly and it's pretty and things like that. One of the things I was thinking about, and I just don't know with the kind of federal entity here, people often want these, like, roadmaps. And so they often want, I want to see a data user agreement, and having one or two is okay. But I'm wondering if there's any way to either encourage people to deposit, to create along with your document a depository. And in the depository, you can then have people, put in kind of their data use agreement. Because what you have to do if you're doing genomics is going to be different than what you have to do if you're doing HIV, which is going to be different then, because some of them actually have laws that govern what you can and can't do. So to the extent that you could kind of grow this, where there's a depository, it would actually be, I think, great for people. I mean, I don't know then, if you want ownership of it, because then they could upload anything and everything. But the community usually is looking for, like a bunch of different type things.
A question and one suggestion. The question is, what public health groups are going to show up at the July 16th workshop? State and territorial public health officers, I'm talking about organizational level folks, the analogs of the industry for state standards for HIPAA transactions.
We have a short list that we've developed through brainstorming, and I'll read off the folks. Debbie Main, is she
Denver.
David Kendricks, Tulsa.
Well, these are people that are like in
Chris?
Examples of people doing work, right? Yeah, I'm talking about institutions.
Okay.
Well, we're hopeful, aren't we, that the Network for Public Health Law through Denise Kreisel will participate.
Yes.
But I know that we need to extend, if we do decide to invite her, we need to extend that invitation the next week or so.
How about the American Public Health Association?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that strikes me as being an opportunity not to miss. Some of the material that Walter circulated, the National Quality Forum today and yesterday, or was it the day before yesterday and yesterday, they have a work group working on a toolkit for communities to use quality measures and stuff. The policy issue is suddenly the world's waking up to this, and there are a lot of different folks that are working in this territory. And it's perhaps an opportunity for us to do our convening role where we help people find each other and share. To the other thing, just the list, a particularly potent group with deep and varied experience is called the High Plains Research Network that covers 18 counties in eastern Colorado that involves every clinical practice, every hospital, and every emergency room. That is overseen by a community governance group where the local folks are part of the governance about what they study, how they study it, what data are needed, and they've become very sophisticated. This is the group that PCORI modeled their recent small grants program to try and get community engagement going on. They will bring a lot to the table. Contact there would be Jack Westfall.
Along those lines that Larry was suggesting. The American Health Lawyers Association has a fairly new public health law section, and I think Gene Matthews, isn't that right, Victor? Gene is the lead on that, and he's a colleague of Denise's. But American Health Lawyers, it would be great to have their representation of their public health law section separate from the Network for Public Health Law.
What was his name, Jack?
Gene Matthews.
Gene Matthews. Vicki.
I think when Larry said this, it just kind of reminded me that there are some groups that are actually all trying to do these community tools, and so getting to those groups might be great. So I'm going to use one of Larry's favorite, which is to go and send this to the CTSI network and ask them to send it to their actual community partners, because they're really on the ground trying to do some of this and have collaborated. The other group I would do the same thing with is called the Campus Community Partnerships, because they're doing the same thing. They actually have partially a toolkit that you may want to look at, and they have some agreements online about, you know, data user agreements. So they would probably be a really big player. And then this is where our federal partners come in, which is if you can get HRSA to send it to their community groups as well, HRSA and SAMHSA, and I think you'd be really covered at that point.
I think we have some logistical questions. We don't fully know yet what our capacity is and those kinds of issues that we certainly need to nail down very soon.
One possibility that we're talking about is to have some ability to continue to update with samples and the data use agreement is a perfect, you know, example. If we could, if at HHS there could be a website where here are some communities, if you're thinking of data use agreements, here are some examples that people have been willing to share.
Yeah, as we looked at it last, we thought this shouldn't be a static document. Not in this day and age with as fast as everything is changing, and that if there's any opportunity on the NCVHS website, that this should be a more dynamic toolkit.
Just a thought, though. You then obligate yourself to make sure that everything that's up there is COPUS. Having just done a similar thing on a different topic, you buy a lot of responsibility.
That's why I was suggesting a repository that somebody else, like a community agency or something,
maintains
for you. Chris? So the last two issues of the National Civic Review really highlighted the 25 years of the Healthy Communities Movement effort, and there are a number of organizations that have been involved in this, but United Ways, YMCAs, other NGOs at the community level, so I just would encourage the group to look at that as well, because there's a lot of activity going on beside public health departments as well in that local level.
Thank you. Larry, did you have another?
Another question. One of the spinoff products of the IOM study that came out a year ago right now about integrating primary care and public health was this playbook. Does that hit you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
They did a press release that we're here on 6th about a month ago.
Yeah.
And that has gotten traction. That's showing up all over the country right now. And it's got many of the same items in it. Using that as an example, rather than see this as a competing community days or user toolkit, it would be very nice to incorporate, particularly the data stewardship idea. There are pieces of this that are missing from that conversation, and there's an opportunity to expose this other work being done at NQF, this other work that's being at these other places.
One thing we could have is a resource page at the end.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And
front
so
part.
To go a bridge too far, you know, I think what we're really trying to create here is a movement. And to create movements, you have to build partnerships. You got to build coalitions and that sort of stuff. And we can trade on our neutrality and our lack of conflicts of interest. We're not trying to promote a particular product. We're trying to get the right people to work together in the right place on the right problems in the right manner. And I suspect that the greater our, the larger area we cast our net into and welcome people to our, forgive me from being from the West, but to our campfire, maybe the fewer bonfires, you know, when people feel like we've just intruded into the turf that they've been in for the last 20 years and we didn't have the courtesy to recognize it.
So our approach to July, and of course, now that we've made the decision to have it be virtual, it doesn't mean that that has to be the only one. I mean, we could give people two dates, one in July and one in the fall, and just round up as much dialogue as we can about this.
Because we do want to bring it back to the full committee in September to wrap it up. So if we do more than one day, I think we do one in July and one in August.
Good ideas. Raj?
Just a question. Are you using this data collection units to collect data, or are you going to do something about it like treatment effectiveness or prediction of outcomes of disease processes?
No. Our goal is really to support communities that are using data for initiatives in their community, helping them to know how to maneuver through the data use challenges, but not the level of rigor that would be done in a research role of clinical effectiveness or other uses of data at that much more rigorous level.
Yeah, and we make a recommendation at a number of junctures where we say, if you want to do this, then you need to partner with someone who does have the experience and training and
the IRB
resources to achieve this. So so we're both trying to give people an intro, but then tell people the types of places they can go to partner in order to do things that if they want to get outside of that comfort area, then you need to bring others in.
That's, to follow on that, that's where I thought the current structure is useful because it notes when you're outside of your wheelhouse and you need to talk to an IRB member or you need to talk to a privacy expert or you need to not keep going because everything you think you need is there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Chris?
A very quick comment. As we've worked with so many communities, there's a different sense of what data means and what it actually is. So maybe bifurcating the use of the word data from, you know, very much population, secondary level, publicly available data, as opposed to the local and regional data that needs to be aggregated to a meaningful, usable level, like with HIPAA and all of the privacy and security things. They're two different paths, and so many people are just trying to get their heads around this publicly available secondary data. Introducing this second stream, that's very clear separation, would help people get their heads around that as well. So.
Yeah, that's good. That could be in the introduction.
We have about five more minutes left on this topic, so the wishes of the group, please. Do you have substantive comments or questions on any of the sections, or have we done enough to kind of orient you to this, and you can provide us with comments or suggestions based on your review, or do you want to do a quick scroll through?
Or we could just pick one section and show people what it looks like if you haven't had a chance to look at it.
What's your favorite, Marie?
Whatever.
Why don't you take purpose?
That was where I was going.
Yeah.
Just show people what it looks like.
Sorry. Okay. So here's the beginning of the purpose specification part. It outlines what purpose specification is, some of the benefits of purpose specification. It then talks about the relationship. I know you can't read this. I'm sorry. It talks about the relationship between community engagement and purpose specification and how the two work together. It talks about the demands of purpose specification, anticipating future uses, for example. So more text on those topics. This is probably one of the most text-heavy sections that there is. One of the points that people are talking a little about, the academic versus the community use, and that's an issue that I think the more data is used at the community level, the more tensions are going to appear. One person mentioned in an email that the IRB requires disclosure of research results, which may be at odds with what communities want, where they may want the information, but they may not want to publicize findings that are going to stigmatize groups within the community. So this is an area that we just brought to, we just noted, but that's an area that I think is going to continue to get more attention. And then at the end, we've got the checklist. It's not formatting quite right on the screen, but at the top of every section, who is the accountable entity or individual for this? What is the purpose of the data? What's the role of the community? What are the elements, what are the data elements needed to achieve purpose? And then it goes through, is the data already available from a source so that people aren't going off to collect new data that may already be available? Possible adverse consequences, individual privacy or confidentiality, impacts, adverse impacts on the community or small group stigmatization, plans to mitigate adverse consequences, possible future use, secondary analysis, repurposing, procedures for considering and limits on unplanned use of data, and describe how to evaluate the need to consider additional consent. So this, one of the things that I think was the biggest challenge in putting this together is that nothing divides cleanly along section lines. So the purpose specifications weaving in and out, the community engagement, the consent and notice issues, everything kind of weaves together. But this demonstrates how that's done in this particular case. And then at the end, and then actually prior to this, would be the blowout box talking about one or two of the case studies that help to illustrate the concept of purpose specification.
One reason for bringing this one up is that so often communities are using data drawn from other sources, and also often other people may want to use, or the community then may want to reuse data that they've collected. And it's an area that's been an area of a lot of tension, not only the academic community, but also lots of questions about, you know, if you gather data to study this or to try to work on this problem, and now you want to turn it to another problem, what's that going to do to the trust of the community if people are surprised?
So any other comments? On the right track?
You know, as I glanced through all the sections, I think you have all the right sections and the elements are really well framed out. I wonder in the introduction if we could spend a little bit more time why this document is important, to whom.
Okay.
Because, you know, it does a good job explaining about the toolkit and so forth, and when you get into all the sections, does a really good job without getting too much detail.
Yeah.
But that introduction's got to be something that grabs you. And you kind of said it earlier, it's not meant for everybody, and you've listed those entities and what they can expect out of this. I think
that's great. Well, thank you, Maureen. I think you've done a yeoman's job on a very difficult task. Thank you. We'll change gears quite dramatically to the other level of sophistication from community user to data segmentation. So, and we've asked Walter, who also is a member of the Privacy, Confidentiality and Security Subcommittee, to continue our discussion. And we've got about 20 minutes for this.
Thank you. Well, I didn't know, of course, that Joy was going to talk about this this topic of data segmentation for privacy, and it turned out to be actually very good because it gave a very good introduction of what I was going to try to cover. So I just wanted to highlight, and just some background, I am actually and have been involved in privacy and security for many years. I have been engaged in the Health IT Standards Committee, and inside the Health IT Standards Committee, co-chair the Privacy and Security Workgroup, which looked at the standards for privacy and security. I have been monitoring, really, and participating in some of these initiatives that have happened in the privacy and security side. I'm also a member of the HL7 Security Workgroup, which is one of the places where standards related to security, health information security, are developed. And when Joy was talking about the data segmentation for privacy, that's why I kind of stepped back and said, you know, when you look at all the spectrum of activities happening with respect and the latest developments that are taking place with respect to privacy and security of health information, it's incredible what is going on, and it's important to bring it back to this committee to be aware of. Not necessarily that we would take a specific actions, we can discuss those very at the end of this, but certainly it's very important for us to be aware of all these developments that are happening and taking place from a technology perspective, more so than the policy perspective. There's policy developments, of course, with ONC's framework for privacy and security, but on the technology side, there's just an incredible amount of work. This is just a brief highlight of the various things that I'm going to talk about in 3 minutes each, so you're going to pardon my speed, but just talk about data segmentation for privacy. You heard about a lot of it this morning. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in it, but there's behind it a lot of things done in the technology side to use electronic tags, if you will, little tags or little markers in the data that become really data about the data that describe some characteristics. And there is a standard coding for those tags already developed, and that's part of what this standard development process is. There's also standards for coding and classifying confidentiality of information electronically, saying this information has this level of confidentiality, tagging it electronically in a medical record. Not a lot of us probably knew about it or are necessarily familiar with it. There's coding to determine the sensitivity of that data in different levels, and it's standard now, an international standard for coding that. And there's other things like e-consent, a larger question that I had about e-consent. Data provenance is a new initiative that is happening. And certainly INSTIC, many of you have heard about INSTIC, the National Strategy for Trusted Identity in Cyberspace, which deals with more the identity of individuals in the electronic world. And it's not just healthcare, it's industry, the entire global economy, if you will. All right, some of the basic drivers, very briefly, you know, sensitivity around privacy and information continues to grow. It's ongoing exposures and breaches. We heard about them in healthcare and in other places. Higher expectations for patient engagement in care. Nothing about me without me. It's sort of the motto, the message. And when it comes to health information, it's more important. Rapid adoption of EHR, so certainly more information electronically is now available, collected, maintained. And there's new requirements and expectations within meaningful use about the security of that information, some of the expectations about what the EHRs need to do with respect to securing the data, but then also handling privacy. Expanded demands for exchange of health information, so even within meaningful use, we're required to electronically exchange information with other providers using standards. And then there's entire HIPAA privacy and security regulations that control really the process and the policies around disclosures and uses of information. And then really ultimately increased expectations of patient controls over their health information. The what to access, by whom, for what purpose, when, how, all those questions. So some very basic definitions for everybody to be maybe in the same page about this. E-consent basically is conceptually being seen as the electronic mechanism to allow consumers to express privacy preferences regarding the collection, maintenance, transfer, access, use, or disclosure of their health information. And this is done electronically. Many of our electronic health record systems and vendors in the electronic health record system world have modules, little modules inside the EHR, some of them mostly refer to ROIs. You probably heard of ROIs,
release of information.
There we go. I was thinking of it. Yeah, so it is an element inside the EHR already that reflects some of these concepts of e-consent. Data segmentation, we heard about it this morning, is the process for sequestering, and I think we were one of the first ones that used that word in our letter back in those days. We're sequestering and segmenting, those two processes. Capturing access view or disclosing certain data elements that are perceived by a legal entity, institution, organization, or individual as being undesirable to be shared. So that's segmentation and the concepts behind it. And it's really a lot of the work that has been done to operationalize that concept. Metadata tags, you know, you've heard of that word a lot, metadata and the tags themselves. Keywords or terms assigned to specific pieces of information, data about data, that helps describe a condition or characteristics of the data for purposes of further action, you know, that allow the electronic systems or a person to take further action about the data. Security labeling is actually something a little newer. Is a process for attaching metadata tags to convey information used by systems to determine how to handle the data from a security perspective. And so they are used to handle things like access control. Someone is wanting to access internally within an organization. A physician wants to see a record for someone. Well, there might be security labels that require certain things before the data can be accessed, even for a physician. So there's that kind of security labeling, and that is a very critical element across all these. This is the one that defines ultimately the tag. And then provenance, the latest addition, which is really something that actually has been mentioned, called, and referenced in other reports earlier. I mean, probably one of the PCAST 2011 report was really a primary element of that report, the provenance concept. Attributes about the origin of health information at the time it was first created, and that tracks the uses and the permutation of the health information over the life cycle of that health information. So it's pervasive and persistent. Here's a very big, quick picture of the security labels concept. And so these security labels are really data pieces, little data pieces, and this looks like a cell with some biologic elements in it, more appropriately, but clearly label information, they're used to clearly label information in order to facilitate human and computer handling of that information. It enables a computer to perform access control operations on the information, so that the information is accessed only by the appropriate and clear people in an appropriate locations. And it has, they have different levels. You know, we heard this morning from Joy that mostly it's been done at the document level. You heard that concept. There's at least three levels that are considered right now. Document level, section or segment level, so within the document there's different sections. And then within the sections there's different data elements. Of course, at the data element level is the most challenging one to tag things, because you can imagine, you know, tagging all sorts of data on a medical record, a multiplicity of data elements about a person in a medical record, and tagging each data element with a lot of information about what's happening with it, it could create a major disruption in the processing of the information. So we're starting, I think, at the document level. You heard this morning from Joy, that's the starting point, but doesn't preclude the ability to do more in the tagging. So a lot of development at the standards development organizations has happened. You heard about the data segmentation for privacy. That was the focus of this morning. Just very briefly, this is actually the document prepared and developed by our HL7 security work group, called the HL7 version 3 implementation guide for data segmentation for privacy, release 1, which is tied to the CDA, the clinical document architecture, R2, release 2, which is a standard that is used in meaningful use to exchange clinical information between providers. So this ties to that standard and adds the layer of data segmentation. It's really the standard that allows electronic clinical documents in CDA form to be tagged at the document, or in this case, it does allow at the segment level, although, you know, it's primarily being done at this point at the document level, with information that allows the system to do two things. Exclude the data from being accessed, used, or disclosed. That's the segmentation part. And then be able to transmit the tags that are attached to the document, this security and privacy tag, so that it can be informed to others. The next person that receives the data, they see the data, and then they see this tag that tells them some things about the data, including some preferences of the consumer or some policy requirements, like you cannot redisclose this data under federal law 42 CFR Part 2, for example, this kind of elements. This particular standard, as was, I think, mentioned by Joy, this, we went through one of the first times where within the HL7 world, we go from developing the standard to jumping all the way to becoming a normative standard. Usually we go through several iterations, including something called DSTU, Data Draft Standard for Trial Use, and we keep it there for a couple of years so that it can be used in a trial form as a standard before it gets normative. This jumped all the way to normative, and we all accepted it and agreed to approve it that way. So it is ready for adoption and implementation. The standard is there, is ready. Nobody has mandated it yet to be used. And the industry can adopt it voluntarily, which is what's happening in some cases. Some organizations are beginning to use it. And others are waiting to see if it's going to be adopted in some law or regulation. For example, meaningful use stage 3. And then become part of the expectation of an EHR. An EHR shall be capable of handling data segmentation for privacy standards, that kind of situation. But there's a lot of other things behind this and beyond data segmentation. One of the more critical ones was also published and developed by HL7 security work group called the International Standards for Healthcare Privacy and Security Classification, a new standard. It sort of uses the what's called a Russian doll nested concept of going from document to segment to element level, and binding security labels to certain data with some information. And the specific categories of the labels are things like the confidentiality classification of the data, or the sensitivity, the provenance of the data, and then there's a few others, obligations, refrain policy, things like that. So these are the actual description of the security labels that are tied back to the data segmentation for privacy standard. The security label is referencing the data segmentation for privacy because the security label is the one that is used. So what are these labels? Everybody talks about these labels. So here's a few examples. I know this is going to be very hard to read, but here are the confidentiality labels that are being used right now. This is standards. This is now official international standards. You can see very restricted. Oh, I guess I don't have my cursor there. Anyway, on this side you can see very restricted, restricted, normal, moderate, low, and restricted. Now, the first question everybody's having probably is, where's the definition of each of these elements? Who decides what is what? Well, there is a definition, and who decides what is the person that tags this with that record. Someone could say, this for me is normal, but someone else might say, no, this is very restrictive for me. Depending on the internal policies of the organization, depending on external policies imposed on the organization, and depending on if this is a consumer choice, depending on the consumer preferences. You can see the sensitivity tag. There's already HIV, sickle cell, VIP, a person that is classified as VIP. We all are, right? Substance abuse, mental health, genetic, there's a number of other sensitivity tags. And so there is a provenance tag also, you know, clinician reported, professional reported. Each of these have already been defined as tags to be used in connection with the data segmentation and the provenance process. And so all this is in place. Nothing is final, of course. This is evolving. And as we find that we need more and better and improved ways to define this tag and to add new tags, then there's a process, and that's part of the standard development and maintenance process that is used. And there's a couple of other tagging. Purpose of use, a lot of in the U.S. mostly. And by the way, this is a lot in U.S. A lot of other countries are following what we're doing, but they don't have the complexity that we have of restrictive and controlling access and use of and disclosure of data by things like purpose of use, treatment, payment, operations, mm-hmm. other things. So you can see here the purpose of use includes those kind of classifications. Obligation stack includes this type of things. When I send you this data, I am by agreement with you as recipient of the data enforcing and requiring you as an obligation to encrypt the data if you're going to maintain it or if you're going to forward it or continue it. There's minimum necessary mask redacted, so a number of these obligations with respect to the data. Yeah, and so it's both applicable to the entity that has the data. So if I have the data and this data has this tag, I know that this data has to be encrypted, that I have to consider minimum necessary before I can use it or disclose it. I might need to mask it. That's part of the segmentation. I need to do all these other things. So very exciting and interesting and innovative stuff really happening around this. All right.
Well, it looks like you have a question here.
Walter, yes. At the risk of being a broken record, I think that the progress that's been made in segmentation is very elegant, but I wonder, what are we looking at the end product that, let's say, if it's exchanging electronic health information among providers, what is the impact on care delivery when elements are sequestered and that sequestration may or may not be known to the provider? And that's not to say that patients don't sequester information in their own giving of the narrative, but I guess the more elegant we get in the segmentation, I think we should be always looking at, and the end product with this will now look like that, and make sure that the end product is going to be usable to the very people who need it to do it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And this is the point that we didn't get to ask Joy or to talk about with Joy, because when you hear this capability, what this is meaning is that an EHR in the future is going to be capable of allowing the entity that maintains that EHR to mark and tag certain things before it gets out. Now, when would I, as an entity or an organization, decide to do that? Well, there's going to be two sources, I think, or more probably, but two at least, that I can think of. One is an external policy directive that makes me tag things. Right now, in general, right now there's only one major one in this country. If you are a behavioral health provider subject to 42 CFR Part 2, you have to do this. Now, you're doing it today. Everybody's doing it today in different ways. In paper, we're redacting. We're, you know, before we send out a record, we have to follow 42 CFR Part 2. Now, this is allowing us to do it electronically as well. That's the only external enforceable requirement. Anything else is chosen by me, and I might not decide to do this as an internal policy to offer the consumer the capability of segmenting any and every type of data they have. Right now, I only am required to do it for one thing, 42 CFR Part 2. Everything else is decided by the organization, and the organization can shut down everything else.
Well, there's state law also.
Well, the state laws require consent, but they don't require segmentation.
I see. Yes.
It's very different.
Yeah.
So.
Well, anyway, is there a group that keeps working in parallel with here's what we can do and here's what the impact will be? It just seems like there's a lot of resources on the segmenting, and I just don't know who the group is that is saying, what have you done to my medical record?
No, yeah, there is going to be probably a lot of analysis about the impact of extending the use of this segmentation to areas beyond 42 CFR Part 2. 42 CFR Part 2 is the one about substance abuse. So if I'm a substance abuse provider, I'm going to have to do this. Beyond that, there's going to be a lot of questions about, well, what if I am doing this for other things beyond 42 CFR Part 2? HIV. I don't want my data to be, you know, shown to my cardiologist that I have HIV. Well, right now, under HIPAA, right now a consumer has the right to request a limitation of disclosures. But they don't have the outright authority or the ability to say, I want this to be segmented. Or, they have the right to request. Please, I would like not to disclose this. But the provider can say, well, we believe that this is integral to the care, and the cardiologist needs to know that you have HIV. So we're not going to acknowledge that. But anyway, let me finish up this. And
okay.
Yeah.
Walter, to ask Justine's question in slightly different language, one of the fundamental tenets of safety engineering is that when you design a process that has obvious potential for adverse effects, you do something, FMEA or prospective risk assessment, different methodologies to try to anticipate what those might be so that you can design the system to decrease their likelihood or at least capture them for review. Has anyone done anything like this for segmentation?
Okay. No, nobody. And really what we are finding is that in some ways technology is pushing the I mean, this is responding specifically to one request and requirement. And what you didn't hear was that the main, you know, supporter of this initiative was SAMHSA in the HHS, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
SAMHSA was the one that put behind, because SAMHSA needed to administer this process. And
my point is that there will be adverse effects, and
yes,
we'll all pretend to be surprised. And it's sort of why we don't encrypt laptops. It's not a secret that you should do a prospective risk assessment. We just don't do it. It's too expensive, too hard, too something or other.
Yes, and my point was going to be basically in this case, technology, by virtue of fulfilling one specific requiring, and it's opening the door for policy to be now added. So technology in some ways is driving.
My point is that SAMHSA should have done a PRA, and my guess is that they did.
Please pardon the interruption.
And we probably need to do that or consider moving in that direction through other groups.
But I think
I don't know if I can.
You made an important point, though. Segmentation and consent are two different things.
Yes.
But they're getting blended, and I think that is the slippery slope.
Yeah.
And not only is segmentation separate from consent, the end, to your point, Justine, about what somebody sees at the end has a huge implication on how somebody interprets
the response that they get in a health information exchange activity. And there's a very, in Walter started to go down this path when he talked about policy. When we start looking at the technology driving a solution capability, but how it's going to get implemented and how it's going to translate into a vendor product that's going to impact how a clinician interprets the presence or lack thereof of data is a huge question.
I think we have Larry, Bob, Leslie, and then we'll roll.
I wanted to ask you guys to connect this up to the toolkit. This sort of information, is it going to be accessible through the toolkit?
No.
This is kind of the way the other end.
I want to declare this a devil's advocacy position. I don't want you to do this. That's not what I'm trying to say. But the more advanced communities want to know this, and they can't get to it. And they don't know how to get to this. Walter started us off with definitions. This is what these two. Take that all the way to then Justine's comment about the difference between data segmentation and consent. Now, these are, this discussion going on right now is, I believe, the bleeding cutting edge of where this nation's communities are in trying to create this integration of clinical data, administrative data, and community data from all over the place. So there's just not very many people that can even identify what the issues are that they need to know about. And we're over a target here. And I take your point. This is not what the toolkit is about. But what comes next?
Mm-hmm.
We may be seeing it forecast right here, right now. And by fall, we may want to be coming back to this territory.
That's why we wanted to probe in this area and see what the implications were.
I agree that consent and segmentation are two different things. However, isn't there a difficult question? Does that make consent even, the capability here makes consent even more granular? Thus, the danger of people, holding even closer to you that they said, let alone able to understand what the heck this is, therefore making them even more.
That's why when Joy was presenting, I mentioned it, data segmentation in many respects is a component of and a workflow element of e-consent and consent in general, because it's tied to it, is a way to executing an aspect of consent. Now, the question that you bring up is, do I have to include segmentation in every consent? In other words, am I required by any something that says e-consent has to be granular enough to allow me to do segmentation? The answer is no. The answer is only there's so far one specific requirement in the federal law that pushes for a segmentation expectation.
What my point is, not now, not yet.
Yeah.
That's a danger. I'm just raising that.
Sure. There's
capabilities are there.
Well, technology is offering that ability to say to policymakers and to policy developers, you have now the ability to push it harder. That's the key.
So,
Leslie, you had your...
Yeah, I wanted to just comment that I've been part, as our liaison to the Tiger team, I've been part of some of these discussions. And one thing I think is really important is that segmentation is about separate management possibilities. It's not necessarily about suppression. And so it's about being able to, so what's currently happening is, and this is the SAMHSA example, is that a SAMHSA provider, because you can't then retransfer without, is not transferring the data at all. So the record isn't getting the behavioral health or substance abuse treatment information. Now, what data segmentation lets you do is put a tag on that when you send it to, and lots of questions about, you know, what the characteristics would be of the document that you send. But once you send it, it enables you to tag it to say, this can't be retransferred without going back then to the relevant SAMHSA permissions. So that's, you know, now certainly it opens doors for other kinds of uses, but the initial use is, or the initial reason for having this is to allow sharing of information that without segmentation wasn't being shared at all.
What, I mean, yeah.
Or.
Yeah, I mean, there's the two sides of this. One is allowing the inclusion of something that I wasn't sending because I couldn't separate. So now I can separate and send only that and tag it and tell the other person, don't disclose it until you comply. The other one is my internal system being able to really exclude some things and be able to disclose the others that I can disclose without any control, without having to have any consent or any other.
Right. Okay, Vicki, you were next. Sally and Justine, and we're kind of bumping up against the end of our privacy, confidentiality, and security time here. So unless we want to spill into standards, which
sure. We
kind of are.
It is.
It's getting up. It's converging.
I want to pick up where Larry was going. As you were presenting, I could see parts, and that's was going to be my recommendation. I could see parts of things that I thought should be a part of the toolkit. For example, when he was doing the definitions, I wouldn't call it that in the toolkit. I would just say some concepts for consideration. Part of what that does is it helps us to bring the community along with some of these complex issues. Some of it has to be kind of rewritten a bit. But I think putting that in there allows them to know how to ask about. They will ask about these things relative to their own data. They will ask about the things when participating. And then they will ask about it when they receive data. And I think we're doing, a contribution to do that. Then there was another point, I'd have to take the slide, but there's another point when he was talking, I thought, this is where we need some cases to kind of give them an example of how these things happen, both for the good and sometimes for the bad. So while you have those cases attached to, in the other section to explain those concepts, I thought some of the cases with the way in which he was explaining electronic health records and things like that would have been perfect. So I really think what Walter has really can be, lack of a better term, dumbed down a little bit more so that it's kind of common language. But it's very educational language. So I really hope that we can get some of that into it.
Would you?
And I would argue this next part, the data provenance, is more so.
Yeah.
He's getting better.
All right.
But, where did the data come from?
Where did the data come from? Yeah. Sally?
Two questions for you, Walter. Before SAMHSA undertook this initiative with data segmentation, did they hold any listening sessions or hearings to see if the notice requirements and the consent requirements were still needed today? Were those validated from consumers?
That the notice?
Right, the notice that has to accompany every disclosure of Part 2 data and the special consent requirement for any onward transfer. Do you know if they reached out to consumers, to patients, to see if it, or providers to see if it?
I wasn't aware, or I'm not aware, but I'm sure that they have reached out quite a bit, and not just consumers, but providers that are part of Part 2, before even doing this whole process. This is, I mean, SAMHSA, this is their big, big initiative from a health IT perspective. So I'm sure they did it, but I'm not familiar with with them, but I know that they had a lot of background done, a lot of work done in preparation for moving this forward.
Second question, who applies the tags to the data?
Yes. Well, so the expectation is that the EHR will have the capability to, through screens, allow the user of that EHR, in this case the provider, or whoever the provider, I mean, the provider could be the physician, the nurse, whomever responsible, the record person, to actually do the tagging. And some of the tagging is automatically done based on some pre-classification of data. Some of the tagging has to be manually done because of not the system not being able to recognize that this data is sensitive. I mean, there's ways that the system can recognize that this data is part two type data. And there's mechanisms in the EHR that allow to do that. There are some other types of data and some other types of systems where manually someone has to really mark it, if you will, tag it. So the EHRs would have those type of capabilities to do either, I mean, basically the automatic tagging as well as the manual tag. But it will be the EHR entity or individual responsible for that. It would not be the patient.
But it would be healthcare policy.
Yeah.
The organization's policy.
Yeah, based on organization policy.
Dostine?
So today, as part of Meaningful Use 2, in the absence of the HL7, it's required that discharge CCD be sent to the primary care physician. And so this seems asynchronous to me because it automatically gets sent to the PCP, who's not the substance abuse physician, and there's no segmenting. And so I'm not quite sure, this seems to be an example of asynchrony where we are, on the one hand, pushing data to a person that I don't know if I understand the law correctly, but I'm not sure the PCP is an automatic person to get the substance data, but that's required by meaningful use, maybe contradictory to the law, and we don't have the technology in place to manage it once that CCD is going there. And I'm just pointing out that as an example of an intersection where this asynchrony creates mischief.
Well, yeah, that is a reality for providers that are meaningful users and that are behavioral health providers classified under Part 2, that if they're going to disclose the data and going to use that for meaningful use meeting requirement purposes, then they have to disclose it in the appropriate way.
Right.
Now, today, there is no tagging in their systems yet. But
vendors have built systems that automatically push the data.
Push the data.
There is no vendor has created any kind of
standard
of that.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think I've made my point.
Great. Thank you. Very quickly to finish up, if I can. And the good thing is the standards committee is probably going to be able to give me some time because we don't have a report to review anymore. We approved them. So anyway, let me finish up. Data provenance is the other big project that is happening. It's separate from e-consent and segmentation. Data provenance really focuses on the question of tagging something to inform the source. So it was, as I mentioned, highlighted as a priority action in the 2011 PCAS report. Uses similar metadata tagging concepts as the data segmentation, various levels, the document level for provenance, data level, section level. Various factors are tagged, basically, who was the author in terms of the individual, the entity, the system source, the daytime stamp, a lot of other things. And really, the intent is to pursue or to convey with confidence to the recipient the authenticity, reliability, and trustworthiness of the information being exchanged so that that person can have a clear way of understanding who is the source, what is the source, and what is the trail of the provenance to validate and decide whether they rely on the data for use or not. So what's happening with data provenance? So we had the PCAS report. Everybody wanted to move in that direction. There is some elements of data provenance already built into things like the CCD or the CDA. So in the CDA, when you send a document from an EHR to another, the header of the CDA, the header of the electronic document, has some provenance in it. So it's already covered, but it's not necessarily consistently used. It's not necessarily complete. There's a number of questions. So there was a need, really, to create a formal initiative to push forward with this. And that's what happened about 2 months ago, literally. I mean, this is very new. Within the Office of the National Coordinator's Standards and Interoperability Framework, SNI framework, a new initiative was created called Data Provenance. The issue that we're trying to address was the non-existence of an authoritative specification or standard or model for provenance in health information. And the goals of the initiative are to really establish some guidance for handling data provenance in content standards, establish the minimum set of provenance data elements that need to be included, and the coding terminology, vocabulary being used, and standardize the provenance capabilities to enable interoperability. So really with the goal of defining those standards so that they can also be included in EHR requirements in the future. The phases of this project right now, the phase one has been completed a week ago, the consensus on the charter and scope of this initiative. The phase two just started, which is the identification and definition of the use cases. Phase three will be the use case harmonization and identification of standards. What are the standards that exist, how mature they are, what's the status of those standards. Then we go into pilots and then evaluation of those. At the end of the day, the outcomes will be and a set of implementation guidelines, best practices, models, but more importantly, perhaps, a set of standard artifacts, basically a set of standards that will be then sent back to one of the standard development organizations because the SNI framework is not a standard development organization. So any products they produce have to come to one of the SDOs, like HL7 or IHE or someone else, to vet them as a standard and then adopt them officially as this is the international standard for coding data provenance. So that's at the end of the cycle. I think this is going to take about 6 months before we can see some of that. The last topic is NSTIC. I'm going to probably skip this. NSTIC basically the strategy to allow a new identity ecosystem to be developed. There's a lot of work being done, and for NSTIC it's been 3 years since we started. Things have been piloted. There was an NSTIC meeting earlier this year to demonstrate the pilots. A lot of the pilots, actually like half of the pilots, were for healthcare, in the healthcare industry. This is not healthcare. This is for every segment of the economy, really. But a lot of them were pilots related to healthcare. And really, the goal here is to identify a mechanism to do what we normally do with respect to identity management. You all have heard of PKI, the public key infrastructure, and the concept of two-factor authentication and all those elements. This is trying to create a now defined, formalized mechanism to identify across the board anybody. The initiative started within the federal government saying, if I'm a consumer, I go to one federal agency, I identify to them in one way with two-factor authentication. So it's not just my login and password. I have to have something that I am, that I know, that I represent. And so I have to do a biometric or some other key or some other thing. But then if I go to another agency, I have to do a different thing. So why not have a common one that they can cross-certify and validate? That's the entire concept of forming an ecosystem that then can be extended beyond the federal government. Healthcare is very into this because there's a lot of identity issues, the identity of the physicians and the providers when they send data across states for emergencies or things like that, the identity of the patients, of course, and other participants. So there's a lot of more work to be done in this. I just wanted you all to be aware of it. So putting it all together, this is my last slide. Participants in a transaction, for example, an information exchange, including patient providers, uniquely identified through an NSTIC mechanism. So this is kind of bringing all those pieces together. The organization defines its privacy and security policies based on external policy requirements and internal organizational policies. Consumer then sets preferences via some sort of an e-consent that allows the consumer to say, yes, I authorize this generally. an open e-consent or have some more granular consent options. The security tags behind the scenes are capturing that information and then automatically tagging different data elements inside or different data parts inside the information of the patient, the electronic record of the patient, defining the confidentiality, sensitivity, integrity, provenance, purpose of use codes. And then whenever the data needs to be accessed or used or disclosed, all those tags are now playing into how a person can access it or use it, or the data can be then put together into a record that can be disclosed or segmented and not be disclosed. And then the important part is the tags are attached to that information that goes out. Now, as I asked Joey this morning, there's two parts of this. One is the tag might be something about a federal law that applies regardless of jurisdiction, 42 CFR Part 2. Doesn't matter which state I am, the recipient of that, even if it's in another state across the country, they have to comply with 42 CFR Part 2 as well. But if I'm in California and I need to give consent before disclosing HIV data, or I can have to get consent, and then I'm able to get that data, and I send that HIV result to someone in Arizona, and I tag the data saying this is a consent required element. Well, it's a consent required element in California. In Arizona, they might have a law that says you can disclose it without consent. So that creates a break in the tags that have to be analyzed, and the organization have to take the tags and determine whether the state laws that allow it or not are required, and their internal policy. So it's very dynamic, and I think we're just at the verge of really getting this moving. Most of these concepts are currently being developed, literally. I mean, you saw the approval of the actual data segmentation for privacy. The date, if you notice, was May 2014,
yeah,
about 15 days ago. So this is literally happening right now. This is not like, you know, the national and international standards are being created. A lot of people are paying attention to what we're doing because a lot of people in other countries want to see how this is done. At least one organization has begun to implement a lot of this, the VA. The VA is very advanced in terms of metadata tagging, segmentation, and having agreement with others to rely upon those data tags. But as I said, no federal or state policy currently exists that requires all these data elements to be put in place. There's one specific requirement, 42 CFR Part 2, for substance abuse. It is expected that for Phase 3 of meaningful use, which starts in 2017, some of these concepts will be incorporated. The expectation that EHRs are going to be capable of handling data segmentation tags and data provenance tags and things like that. So we expect that that's going to be happening. I don't know that on the meaningful use requirement side, you know, there's two parts of meaningful use, the standards that are adopted and the certification program, and then what we need to do as meaningful users. We have to do 80% of our exchanges doing this. I don't know if they might put some requirement that says 80% of your disclosures have to have a tag. I don't think that's going to work. I hope it's not going to go that way. But at least in the standards, there will be a requirement that if you are going to certify as an EHR, if you're going to get a certification that you are an EHR certified system, you're going to have to meet this requirement. I expect that that will happen. And that's my last slide.
Yes, I have one quick question. It's interesting that slide about NSTIC, is that right?
NSTIC.
That is not to be confused with patient identify.
It is not. Well, it's not. Actually,
however, would this...
On the contrary, this is a ability for the consumer to be identified without being identified. In other words,
right,
be identified with a code, with a mechanism that allows them to do business without disclosing who they are in reality, in terms of the actual person specifically. So it is an ecosystem that allows the unique identification of the participants in a protected way.
Got it.
Okay.
Wow, that was great.
So I will make this available to the
right
committee members, the presentation,
yeah,
the slides.
That'd be great. Our purpose here was just to do an overview and chew on what it might mean for us, and I certainly think it catapults us to a new level of thinking about what privacy and confidentiality and security is going to mean in very short time frame.
Yes.
Very good.
A rocket, not a
catapult. A rocket, yes. So I think with that, we are adjourned, and thank you so much for feedback. And
now we turn to standards.
Now let's go to standards.
Do we have a break?
Nah.
It's a self-break. It's not.